On this episode of Skeptico, near-death experience skeptic, Dr. G.M. Worley.
What I think most people would focus on, this woman died. I mean, her doctors reported that she died. They hit her with the paddles 3 times. There isn't a good medical explanation for how you could see them preparing and defibrillating your body while you're dead.
The thing is that she hears the conversations, she feels the sensations, and she also is a woman who also has seen films, and she knows how these things go.
But she's dead. That's why they're defibrillating her.
No, she is not dead. Why do you say she is dead?
Because the doctor says that she had died when she comes back, and that he hit her with the defibrillator 3 times because she wasn't responding the first 2 times.
If she was dead, the doctors would not have resuscitated her. She would have remained dead.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we continue our discussion on near-death experience. Now, many of you who follow the show will know that we've done quite a few in this series, and to me, it just keeps getting more interesting the more we delve into it, and especially the more we get this interchange going between skeptics and proponents. But I do have to tell you, we're kind of running out of skeptics. So if anyone is out there and knows a qualified scholar, researcher who takes the skeptical position on near-death experience and you think articulates it particularly well, we'd love to hear about them because we've pretty much exhausted everybody that I know, although we're going to continue to find some folks out there to talk about it. At this point, there just really isn't a lot of good, solid skeptical arguments against near-death experience. And the guest that we have on today is someone who you've heard from before on the show, Dr. G.M. Worley, an anesthesiologist in the Netherlands, who's published a book entitled Mortal Minds, The Biology of Near-Death Experience. And this, I think, will probably be the final round with Dr. Worley. I think we pretty much got to the end of this discussion as far as we can take it. But of course, it'll be interesting to hear what you, the listener, think with regard to that. Here's my discussion with Dr. G.M. Worley. Today, we welcome back Dr. G.M. Worley, an anesthesiologist in the Netherlands, an NDE skeptic, and the author of several books, including Mortal Minds, The Biology of Near-Death Experiences. Dr. Worley, welcome back to Skeptico.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you back. You know, as I mentioned during our last visit, I think it's good and it's really useful to have this give and take back and forth over a couple sessions because it really takes a couple rounds to dialogue on these issues properly. So here's where I'd like to start today. As many skeptical listeners will know, of course, we've had this series of discussions on near-death experiences. We've talked to a number of NDE researchers, as well as qualified skeptics like yourself. And the last time around, you presented the evidence for your claims regarding the possibility that near-death experiences can be explained by normal processes that are understood by physicians like yourself. Since then, we've heard from Dr. Jeffrey Long, of course, and we've also heard from some other folks who've posted on the website, and they have some, some pushback, some doubts about your claim. So the principal claim that you make against the NDE researchers is that they've ignored the fact that these patients who have this horrendous brush with death, that they're receiving CPR, they're receiving chest compression. Someone's coming around and pounding on their chest, and that's pumping blood into their brain, and this flow of blood is causing them to regain consciousness. Kind of an NDE by CPR theory, if you will. And here's the quote from your actual website, and you say, "And then Jeffrey Long proceeds to make the same unbelievable assumption as just about every other doctor publishing studies on near-death experience during cardiac arrest. He forgets to tell us that all those who survived cardiac arrest underwent cardiac massage." So that's where I really want to start digging into that statement. All those who survived cardiac arrest underwent cardiac massage. Because as I think we touched on before, but which has become even more clear since then, that's not really accurate. In fact, it's not really even that close. And one of the papers I sent you was from Keith Wood, a Skeptico listener. And what he pointed out, and I thought this was interesting the way he did it, he he went into the Pin von Lommel study, the paper that you actually cited on your site. And in that, he states that 81% of the patients he looked at, they suffered cardiac arrest. It was in the hospital, and within 2 minutes, they were resuscitated. And as we know, that means they were most likely resuscitated by defibrillator. So it's reasonable to assume that most of those people weren't administered cardiac massage. And then further, he points out that only 21% of the patients who were outside of the hospital received CPR before they got to the hospital. So let me stop there and see if we can kind of nail this down. Do you still maintain that all those who survive cardiac arrest in these NDE studies, that they all underwent cardiac massage?
No, but then I'll go on about this this critique, and I believe you're referring to that article by Keith Wood, which you posted on another part of your site. It's a 12-page long PDF. And actually, Keith Wood actually does a very good analysis. He actually has read the articles he cites, which is very good. He also points out very correctly, something an oversight of mine, that 81% of the people that Pin von Lommel reported in his article were actually people resuscitated on coronary care units. Now, then we go on further, because he is quite correct in some, as in many of these aspects. He also referred to his sister, who is a qualified coronary care intensive care nurse and who does primary resuscitation in these units. Now, the big problem is this, that most people who are resuscitated from a cardiac arrest are actually not in a coronary care unit or an intensive care unit. Most of them are actually outside such a place. Now, what happens is that you must always make a very big distinction between people resuscitated in a coronary care and intensive care versus people resuscitated elsewhere in a hospital and people resuscitated on street or at home. You look at the mortality of the different resuscitations and you see immediately what the difference is. A person in a coronary care unit or an intensive care unit is already attached to an ECG monitor with a central bank of monitors which are continually observed by the nurses and doctors present at the moment, at the time, who are on duty. They see an arrhythmia which needs treatment, and they immediately jump upon the patient and, if it's necessary, defibrillate. If that does not work, then what they do is they start cardiac massage while they have a think about what to do next, or charge up the defibrillator for another go. So, in other words, some of these people do receive cardiac massage, because in such situations, if you do not do any cardiac massage, these people are severely brain damaged.
Right. And I don't think we'd really see much of a disagreement between you and any of the NDE researchers on that description of what's going on.
No.
But what I want to kind of hone in on, because in your article, I do have to say you make quite a bit of a fuss about this point and the point that you're now backing off of, which is great. And everyone should be allowed to back off and say, hey, I didn't mean all when I said all. But that is what you said. You say, here's the big missing link in this argument, is that all those who survived cardiac arrest underwent cardiac massage, underwent chest compressions. And now we're saying no. And we're saying really the actual figure, I don't know, but it seems to me from the Pin von Lommel study, and also, you know, on Dr. Long's research, all of his are published on the website. And I went on there and searched for the accounts of how many people, just roughly estimating how many people received chest compressions as opposed to the paddles and the shock treatment. And, you know, it's maybe 50-50. So where does that really leave us in your argument if only half the people are associated with people who had heart massage?
No, there is a number of factors here. In fact, I still maintain that most of them would have received cardiac massage for the very simple reason you lose consciousness within 4 to around 30 seconds after ventricular fibrillation, a real ventricular fibrillation begins, or asystole, in other words, no heartbeat at all, begins. So, and what happens is that within that time, people lose consciousness. Now, it is not a matter of minutes or something like that. If you do, consciousness is sustained for minutes continually, that is not a ventricular fibrillation, but a ventricular tachycardia. Why is that? Because that can sustain circulation for some time. A real ventricular fibrillation does not. So, in other words, what you actually have are a very selected group of patients who do report their story. And that actually coincides with that article of Wood, in the sense that the only people who actually give a coherent near-death experience story are those who have been well resuscitated, in other words, resuscitated on time and adequately.
No, that's not true. I mean, that doesn't conform. Here's the other thing I wanted to do before we get too far in. Let me read you an account. So we're talking about the same thing, because sometimes when we talk in abstract terms, and certainly when you get into medical terms, which you're extremely well versed on, and you obviously have a lot of expertise in that, and I don't, and I don't think a lot of listeners do, I think we get away from the actual data that we're talking about. And this data in this case are the survey results from all these people that Long talked about. So let me throw this on the table, and it's going to touch on a couple of points that we're going to talk about, including resuscitation, including anesthesia, and including the accuracy and the details that someone provides. So if I can, let me read this into the record here, and it'll take a minute or two, but I think it'll be interesting. This is from a girl named Kimberly who was shot during an attempted rape, horribly enough. And here's her account. I had never once lost consciousness or went into shock, which amazed everyone. I can still remember everything in perfect detail. As the helicopter landed, I did feel sleepy. They told me not to go to sleep and began running with me down a long hallway in the hospital. I remember counting the lights on the ceiling as they whizzed by to stay awake. They took me into the operating room and began to prepare me for surgery. The last thing I remember was them putting a mask over my face and telling me to count backwards from 10. The last number I remember was 8. That should sound familiar to you.
Well, the business of counting to 10 is ridiculous, but anyway.
That's how they did it in Houston, Texas back then anyway.
Yeah, more of a diversion. Okay, keep going.
Then I felt like I was walking backwards with my eyes closed. Then I felt like I bumped into a wall with my back. I opened my eyes to a very bright, although strangely not blinding, white, misty light that covered everything. Slowly the mist started to move away and I saw myself lying on the operating table. So she's having an out-of-body experience. It looked like I was many, many stories high and looking down on myself. I saw them working on me. I noticed that I heard, not with my ears, but more like with my spirit, something like singing voices or speaking, but I couldn't make out the words. It was all around me. At this point, I turned around and saw what was the tunnel. I started toward the tunnel in a motion. It seemed like as soon as I entered the tunnel, I was on the other side that quick. I noticed the same bright light and mistiness of the surroundings. I also noticed that I wasn't alone. There seemed to be a dozen people standing in a horseshoe formation, which I was standing in the center of. I could not recognize anyone because I saw no features. They were more like shadows. Then I was told no by a voice. The strange thing that it was neither male or female, but held an enormous amount of authority. Then, with my stubbornness that I carry to this day, I asked, why can't I come home? I was told, you cannot come home yet. I continued to try and go forward and keep telling me, no, not yet, it's not your time. Then I felt completely compelled to turn back and look at the tunnel. That's when I was transported back through out of the other side of it. Okay, and now that's rather long, but here's the part that I think is really going to be important for our discussion. I looked down, and that's when I saw them bring the paddle machine over to my body, so she's going to be defibrillated. I saw the doctor grab the paddles, say something to the person standing next to it, then they turned some knobs. The doctor put them on my chest and hit me once with the shock. I saw my body jump, but I felt nothing. Then I saw the doctor say something to them again. They moved the knobs again and hit me a second time. Nothing. Then I saw... Okay, so again, out-of-body experience. Then I saw the doctor put the paddles back together for a moment as if saying a prayer and then said something to the person again. This person shook their head in disagreement but went ahead with the doctor's insistence and moved the knobs again. Then he hit me a third time and I awoke in the ICU. My parents were told by the doctor that I had died. I was what they call sheet-faced, and they took a chance by hitting me with the paddles a third time. He admitted, this is the doctor, admitted to not being a religious man, but he felt that he was being told not to quit, so he didn't. So the particularly relevant part of this story that I wanted to talk about, and this is not a unique story. This isn't like one account. Again, he collected all this data from 1,000 people and he analyzed it in a number of different ways. But it clearly shows someone who, if you read the whole account, which I didn't bother doing, she never received heart massage because she was losing blood really badly. And that's why they thought she was going to die. So, I mean...
Well, if we talk about this specific case, what you actually have is a woman who is shot, brought into hospital, losing blood rapidly, had to undergo surgery for that because I'm not sure where she was shot, but in any case, usually there is some blood loss and they do an exploratory laparotomy, thoracotomy, open up the chest or open up the abdomen to see where the blood loss is and to repair any damage that might be there. Now, the thing is, this experience of walking backwards with the eyes closed in this white light, there is no real difficulty with that. These are the proprioceptive experiences of falling asleep sometimes. Usually that's black, but some people can experience white because with open eyes they see operating theater lamps. That's not a big problem. She sees also her out-of-body experience. Now, actually, out-of-body experiences do occur during anesthesia. There have been a fair number described also in the scientific literature, and usually that is basically due to the, proprioceptive effects, but that doesn't mean anything to the listeners. Proprioception is the sense of knowing where your body is and where your body parts are. Now, the problem with anesthetic drugs, and you see it when you hear some patients, is that some of them have very strange effects. Some of them lose the, if they're awake, that is, and also the effects of anesthetic drugs tested with awake people. They lose their sense of body position, sometimes due to stimulation. They can get muscle spindle, their special movement sensors, stimulation, whereby actually out-of-body experiences can occur. There is a particular drug which actually induces a lot of these types of out-of-body experiences. So this is actually not so difficult to explain. What you then have is a near-death experience. Basically, some people, even under anesthesia, during induction, especially during traumatic moments like this, they have... And there have been one or two cases reported, even in scientific literature, of ecstatic experiences. So this does not surprise me. The other problem is with this woman, she has lost a lot of blood, so the anesthetic is, of course, very light. All anesthetic drugs, they depress the heart, they depress the circulation, and so what do anesthetists do when the blood pressure falls away? They administer drugs to increase the blood pressure, improve the heart action, but when that fails, they lighten the anesthesia. And this is commonly what happens with multi-traumas. In fact, the incidence of awareness during anesthesia for multi-traumas is up to around 43% in some series. So I'm not surprised this woman had a form of awareness, which she interpreted together with the effects of the anesthetic drugs as this. And the out-of-body experience, yeah, that can happen because of the proprioceptive changes. As for this tunnel, yeah, there are many different explanations for tunnel experiences. I have one. Dr. Blackmore proposed also a very good, reasonable explanation for that in her book in 1991. As for this visionary experience of meeting people at the other side, and them saying, it is not your time. This is a typical, fairly typical American transcendental experience.
Right, but Dr. Worley, I mean, what we're dealing with here, what I think most people would focus on, especially in the context of our conversation, is this woman died. I mean, her doctors reported that she died. They hit her with the paddles 3 times. And just like in all the other discussions we've had, she's viewing this from above, and she's seeing everything happening. There isn't a good medical explanation for how you could see them preparing and defibrillating your body while you're dead.
The thing is that she hears the conversations, she hears, feels the sensations, and she also is a woman who also has seen films, and she knows how these things go. She hears the conversations. Why? Because she is awake. That does not surprise me.
But she's dead. That's why they're defibrillating her.
No, she is not dead. Why do you say she is dead?
Because the doctor says that she had died when she comes back, and that he hit her with the defibrillator three times because she wasn't responding the first two times. And that's what I read into this account.
No. What I read is this. They started resuscitation. The defibrillator is not standard in an operating theater. It just isn't present. That always has to be hauled from a central place in the operating theater complex. So until such a defibrillator arrives, they do apply cardiac massage. Second, at the same time, the anesthetist lightens the anesthetic. That means he stops administering any anesthetic gases and any other drugs that he may be administering. So these people, the anesthesia lightens. This is the reason why there is such a high incidence of awareness among people undergoing operations for multi-trauma. That means a severe injury. Therefore, according to me, this woman was just awake, admittedly, under anesthesia, according to many people, but this was not so because the anesthesia was lightened. But even if she was under anesthesia, she would have still had the effects of muscle relaxant drugs. Muscle relaxant drugs, they are known when they are administered to awake people in concentrations high enough to cause them to be totally paralyzed so they cannot breathe or move or do anything. They do cause loss of body image in many people. That is, together with any residual effects of any anesthetic drugs, that people also cannot move. This has also been experimentally determined. Other things, and residual effects of low concentrations of any anesthetic gases, they can cause transcendental experiences. This is also known. For instance, laughing gas is a well-known one. Now, as to whether she can hear and see and build up a mental image, she is awake, true, affected by the effects of anesthetic drugs, but awake enough to observe with her ears and senses. She does not report cardiac massage for the very simple reason she was not awake at that time, but she would have certainly had it. And I cannot even imagine that would not have been done, because she would not have been awake during that time and have observed it.
See, I guess this is where we get to the point where we just have to kind of back off and leave it to people to decide. Because to me, that just sounds like a rather fantastic interpretation of this particular case in particular and the overall data in general. And that's where statistics can be useful. And we've talked plenty about statistics, that the chances that someone would be aware.
And one thing on this particular case, if she was dead, the doctors would not have resuscitated her. She would have remained dead.
Certainly. I understand what you're saying, but that gets into a definition of what dead is. But certainly from the description here where they're hitting her the first time, nothing's happening, they're adjusting the knobs. I don't know what adjusting the knobs mean, but...
Well, they're increasing the charge of the capacitor in the thing.
That's what I figured. So obviously she's not responding from this, and she's, for all intents and purposes, what most of us would call, you know, dead, but...
Well, she had no heartbeat. But she was not dead.
Okay, so she had no heartbeat, and yet she's observing all of this from above her body. So, again, I think we just get to the point where we just have to kind of step back and say, you know, what you're continuing to claim is that the statistics, even though they're unbelievably lopsided against your claim, and that's that, you know, in this case, let's look at the statistics. What are the chances that someone has anesthesia awareness? You know, 1 in 1,000. What are the chances that that person wouldn't have any of the effects that they normally see under anesthesia awareness?
Now, over statistics, I can also mention something during anesthesia. In America, in the USA alone, around 40 million operations take place every year. And that is according to the anesthesia quality studies. Now, if you have 1 in 1,000 or 2 in 1,000, there are statistics which are actually cited in modern studies of awareness, I can even give you the references if you like. That means that per year in the United States alone, there are 40 to 80,000 people who have an experience of awareness during anesthesia.
Yeah, but in this sample, what we're talking about, and again, I think we're just going to kind of drown people on a bunch of statistics that don't really mean a lot. Because in this case, you know, Dr. Long looked at 1,000 cases. He looked at about 200 cardiac arrests. I mean, if we were to talk to some cardiologist, some surgeon, and say, what are the chances? Forget the anesthesia for a minute. You know, what are the chances that someone during a heart attack had a very lucid, very real memory of their heart failure and their resuscitation? Well, they would put those odds at very, very, you know, high, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000. And yet you're suggesting that of all the people that he looked at, the chances that they had this just lined up perfectly to fit this data. I just don't think many people are going to find that very believable.
I think basically what you're looking at saying is this. To begin with, you should never ask a surgeon about this type of thing, because surgeons just don't know. There's a joke about surgeons, how do you ask them to commit suicide, to jump from the ego to their IQ? But that's something else. The big problem is that with 40 to 80,000 people per year, now, Dr. Long has collected over many years, 40 to 80,000 people per year have an awareness under surgery. Dr. Long has collected in all his years with his excellent database of patients who have awareness under anesthesia together with a near-death experience, and they do occur under anesthesia. There's a very good one in a scientific article a few years ago of a young boy. But that means that he has collected over 20 years only 23 cases of awareness or a near-death experience during general anesthesia. And a near-death experience as defined by the Near-Death Experience Index of Bruce Grayson, which is actually a good index, and that is over 20 years. In other words, 20 years by 40,000 people. In other words, you have a data, a potential base of several, now around 800,000, nay more, patients, which out of which to choose, and 23 of which actually registered their experience with Dr. Long. In other words, you're speaking about a statistical probability.
I don't want to go there because I don't think you can really do the calculations that way. That wasn't the population that he was drawing from. But
no, he has spontaneous cases. These people registered their case or their experience with him, and that is out of a potential many hundreds of thousands of people who have awareness.
I mean, the other way of looking at this, and the way that I think is kind of a more fair way of looking at it, is to say that let's look at the cardiac arrest patients he looked at. There are 200 of them. We know from the Pin von Lommel study and many other near-death experience research that, let's say, 10 to 15% of people who have cardiac arrest have some sort of near-death experience. So just extrapolating out, what we can say is this is a population of about 2,000 that he looked at. So he looked at 200. It represents about 2,000 patients. And the chances that in that 2,000, any of the things that you're talking about would occur are just astronomically high, that they'd occur as frequently as they do. You know, his stats, again, 76% of these people report that it's a realer than real experience. The accuracy rate, over 90%. It just doesn't add up. And then when we read this particular case, I just was listening to your explanation for it. I don't know. I think at this point, we just have to leave it up to the listeners. If listeners accept your explanation of Kimberly's case, the woman who was shot, then I guess they just have to go with it. For me, it satisfies me to the extent that I'm very glad that you came on and were able to kind of offer your specific response to a case that represents a lot of cases in the database. I think that clarifies things.
Actually, it is an interesting case. But then we talk about cardiac arrests. Now, the only people we talk to, or people talk to, and whose experiences we know of, are the ones who survived cardiac arrest. As I say, that's around 40% of people, 40-45% of people in coronary care units, and around 20% of people in the general hospital ward, and only, 7 in some situations to 2% of people who are resuscitated at home or on street. In other words, there are a lot more people who actually die than actually survive. Then of those survivors, many are brain damaged. In other words, they cannot tell any story at all. And in fact, there's this article of Keith Wood said they suffer all the effects of brain damage due to oxygen starvation as a result of cardiac arrest. The ones who are very efficiently resuscitated, they tell a coherent story, a good story, and can also, and many of them have even undergone a near-death experience. And the ones that can tell a very good story are those who suffer some effects of severe oxygen starvation, and they are confused, uncertain. So in other words, what we're speaking about here is a very select, small group of patients out of the many, many thousands who have been resuscitated.
I think you've done a great job of summing up your case and your points. Are there any other points that we haven't touched on that you'd like to add before we wrap things up?
Let's have a look. I was reading that article by Keith Wood. It's actually a good thing. He's missed a number of points. I'd like to compliment him on his work for reading and doing a careful analysis of the papers he did. The only problem is that he did miss out on the concept of averages with cerebral blood flows, etc. But for the rest, I think that, as you say, that basically what we would have here is differences of opinion as regards many things. Dr. Long mentioned at the end of his last conversation with you that I tend to look at only one aspect, basically that I have an aspect of cardiac massage, cerebral blood flow. Another critic that you once interviewed, a certain Dr. Nelson, looks at REM intrusion, and he mentions, I did not mention this. Now, that basically is because this was not brought up in the discussion at the time. As I say, I believe near-death experiences are a common product of many different causes. As I say, oxygen starvation is one. Awareness during anesthesia, another. Fear and other anxiety states, another. And you could go on and on. In other words, there is no one single explanation for the cause of the near-death experience. But the final result is what we all know as the near-death experience. That's my last word on the matter.
Great. Well, I think that's a good wrap-up and an explanation of why there's so many explanations. Well, Dr. Worley, again, thanks for coming back on, and we'll get this out so that we can keep the dialogue going. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Dr. Worley for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show and a link to Dr. Worley's site, and in particular a link to Keith Wood's write-up that was referenced repeatedly in this show, check out our Skeptico website. It's at SKEPTIKO. Don't forget the K in there. You'll also find links to all our previous shows, an email, Facebook link to me, and a link to our forums. Many more interesting episodes coming up. Have some interviews on the Global Consciousness Project and some other cool stuff. So until next time, bye for now.